Coming up on Tech News Today, we go deep into the Void VR experience. We find out why Google is feeding its AI smut fiction. Mary Jo Foley bumps into Satya Nadella and has to come to terms with the fact that she chose Android over Windows Phone. And Lyft is bringing autonomous vehicles to its fleet as early as next year. That's right. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1507, recorded Thursday, May 5th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
And by Trunk Club. Get clothes that fit and look amazing without ever stepping into a store again. Trunk Club will help you create the wardrobe you've always dreamed of with your own personal stylist. Go to trunkclub.com/TNT and join Trunk Club today.
And by Blue Apron. Blue Apron will send you all of the ingredients to cook fresh, delicious meals with simple step-by-step instructions right to your door. See what's on the menu this week and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. That's blueapron.com/twit. Hello, welcome to Tech News Today. This is a show where we talk about all the hottest tech news of the day.
Oh, man, I always touch the tech news and it burns me hot.
Don't touch the tech news.
I should know.
I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell, and sitting next to us is a guy named Father Robert Balasair.
That's me.
How's it going?
Pretty good, actually. We're getting a little bit of rain in California. I kind of like this.
I didn't know that was going to happen today.
That was impressive, actually. We got thunder. We haven't had thunder in a long time.
Yeah, it's nice. That's because the skies knew that Father Robert Balasair was going to be on Tech News
that's
today.
That's what I do. I bring the rain.
Let's do it.
Yeah, let's get to our first guest, who is no stranger to rain, I'm sure. Microsoft says 300 million active devices are now running Windows 10, and the company has confirmed to Mary Jo Foley and others that the free upgrade will actually end on July 29th for reals. Mary Jo Foley is here to talk to us about this. Welcome, Mary Jo.
Hi, guys.
Good to have you here.
So we really only have until July 29th. No backseas on that, I guess.
Yeah. And you know what's funny about that is this morning when I talked to Microsoft, they gave me a different story and they kind of left themselves a little wiggle room about that date. And then they came back and said, we're going to give you a different statement now. And that's it. July 29th. It's done. No more extensions, no more renewals of the program. If you don't have the free upgrade by then, that's that.
And after that, it'll cost $119. Is that what we're looking at?
Right. If you buy a copy of Windows 10 Home for your PC, you'll pay that, or you'll have to go out and get a new device that is running Windows 10.
So it's 300 million active devices that it's running on. What does that include?
It includes PCs, tablets, phones, even the Xbox One console, even IoT devices as well. So they're lumping everything in there together. We can't say how many of those are exactly PCs versus non-PCs, but I think the majority are PCs.
And you said HoloLenses too, which I thought I was writing that, and I was like, HoloLenses? I don't know if that's the plural.
HoloLens eye.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking of it as I said it. I'm like, is that plural? I'm not sure.
Because there's, or, you know, it is now. We don't see a lot of them together.
That's true.
Or any of them.
No.
Mary Jo, I have to ask you this. One of the questions that we get a lot is, okay, if I install the Windows 10 upgrade on my Windows 7 or my Windows 8 box, and let's say on August 1st, my machine crashes and I have to go back to my install disk and it puts 7 or 8 back on, am I not able to get Windows 10? How does that policy work?
No, you still can get it. They have a registration that you are a legal user so that you'll be able to reinstall it. Fine, in theory, at least.
So I guess the advice to people would be do the upgrade, even if you're going to end up using 7 or 8 for a while, because after that, you won't be able to get it for free.
Right. Although, there are always exceptions. Like, I'm one of those exceptions. I'm still running Windows 7 on my desktop, even though I'm running Windows 10 on my laptop. So there are some of us who have decided we don't really want the upgrade, and we're going to just kind of tough it out till we replace our machine, basically.
Now, the more important question is, if I hold out on my Windows 7 box on July 29th, will I stop getting that little nag screen that pops up every couple of hours?
Yes.
that's good news for news organizations as well, by the way.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
And weather reporters everywhere are very happy to hear that.
Right. It may take them a little time to stop that upgrade to Windows 10 message because it took a while to kind of phase that in, but they said it is going away.
Oh, that makes me very, very happy.
Yes.
I'm like you. I have Windows 10 boxes. In fact, some of my newer laptops are running Windows 10. I like it. But I have some tools that will only work in 7, and 10 breaks them. So, you know, it's just what I have to use.
Yep. And you know what? You can keep using Windows 7 till 2020. You can still get updates, security updates for it till then.
Wow. Right.
So there's no huge rush if you've decided to stay with Windows 7.
So for the average person, you would recommend that they upgrade?
Long side.
I have trouble giving general guidance because every time I say, you know what, I think everybody should upgrade, there's always someone who says, I have a printer that won't work with it. Or, you know, there's just a million reasons I can't have it. I don't want it. So I'd say if you don't have it by now and you think you want it, you should probably get it in the next couple months. But if you are someone who's holding out and you have your reasons, I'm not telling you to upgrade.
Right. And what I've done is I've gone ahead and I've registered. I did an upgrade on 3 of my boxes, and then I just reverted back to an original image. It didn't take me that much time. And it means that in the future, if I ever do feel like I can trust Windows 10, I'll go ahead and shift those boxes over.
That's a good way to do it.
Yeah, it's a good point you have. I mean, if you haven't already done it, I mean, most people who just don't even, you know, don't think too much about it have done it, and they're probably fine with it.
Yeah, sure. Mary Jo, we do have to ask you about, we've heard rumors that Satya Nadella came by and really wanted to talk to you, but you were busy. You were really, really busy. What was going on with that?
Well, this is funny today. I was over at the Microsoft New York office in Times Square. I was having a meeting there. So I came back out and I was sitting in the lobby, and all of a sudden there's like Satya and his entourage that entered the building. And I see him and I was like, oh, is he going to come and talk to me? Or is he just going to pretend he doesn't see me and walk by? So he came right over, was all friendly. And you know what he asked me about?
Your
my
phone?
Android phone.
Oh, no.
Could have guessed.
he said to me, Mary Jo, I'm really curious. How are things going with your Android phone? I heard you moved to Android. And I was like, uh-oh, this is a trick question. You know, is he going to do a Steve Ballmer and take my phone and smash it to the ground?
Throw a chair across the room. Yeah.
Right. He actually wanted to know, and he wanted to know about how I thought the Microsoft services were working with Android. And he was very interested to hear that. And he said, you know, as long as you're a PC user and I see you're using Windows 10, it's all good. You use what you got to use.
I love that. I mean, because yours was a switch heard around the world, I think, you know, if anyone. And I loved your piece on it. I also love how unapologetic you are against all Apple devices, except that iPad that you had for 15 minutes. We all have that 15-minute iPad regret sometimes. But yeah, I just think that's wonderful that he knew that and came to ask you about it. That's fascinating.
Me too. And he really wants to hear people's experiences on other devices. Because you know what they care about in the end? They care about Microsoft services and software on whatever device it is. Because you're still a Microsoft customer, even if you're not using a Microsoft operating system.
Yeah, that conversation could have been very different 2 years ago.
Right.
And right now, I mean, man, Microsoft and Android, I feel like every week, you know, doing the Android show on this network, almost every week there's a new Microsoft app. And it ends up always kind of being so cool that we have to talk about it. So they're doing some pretty interesting things on Android for sure.
Yeah. I mean, if you ever want to borrow allaboutmicrosoft.com, I could loan it to you for like a minute or something.
I might end up turning it into All About Android for a minute or something. It could get very confusing.
I've already done that twice. I've said Mary Jo Foley is the host of All About Android. And she goes, no, stop.
It's so confusing. Sorry about that.
He has done that. That's why I threw that little.
Maybe a future host? I don't know. Watch your back, Jason.
All right.
Mary Jo, thank you so much for joining us. Mary Jo is at ZDNet on Windows Weekly every week. and at Mary Jo Foley on Twitter. Thanks so much for coming on and telling us your tales.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Have a wonderful night.
Thank you.
All right, if there's one thing that will churn through your data on mobile, it's streaming video, we should know. So having controls to manage that data usage is always welcome. Netflix is one of the biggest destroyers of data. Last year, a report stated that Netflix accounted for 37% of all internet traffic at peak hours. The company is now adding controls into its mobile app to allow users to determine just how much mobile data they'll use, particularly when users end up on a high-speed connection where an app might simply just take everything it can get. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings announced this and some other news we'll get to in a second. But I think, you know, obviously more control is better. And when you're talking about Netflix, just having the ability to control this kind of stuff, I mean, 37% of all internet traffic, that could make a huge difference in a lot of ways.
This also makes a lot of sense for mobile devices, which is where, I mean, that's where we're seeing this usage, because most of us watching something on a tiny little screen that maybe is just on the side as we're working, we don't need maximum resolution.
Oh,
we're not
totally
using the maximum resolution. Yeah. In fact, most of us at that distance wouldn't be able to tell the difference between a stream that gives you 4 hours per gigabyte and one that gives you 1 hour per gigabyte.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So the fact that I can actually force it now and not just hope that Netflix will choose one that's not going to destroy my data plan,
right.
I like that. That's good.
The interesting thing is they were doing this anyway. Like they were
they were scaling it back. Yeah.
And sending you these, you know, doing it for you. And then people complained. They were like, well, what, you know, they're sending it. And they're like, well, we're doing it for you to save your bandwidth. Mm-hmm. And or your, you know, minutes or, you know, your
data.
Whatever data. and now they just are, you know, letting you control it, letting you decide.
Yeah, it was 600 kilobits per second, which basically for 3 hours of video content equals around a gig of data. That's what they were doing before. Now they're doing that by default.
Right.
But then if you want, you can stream at higher quality all the way up to unlimited, which they, you know, they built in kind of a warning around that because that could get out of hand, I imagine, if you didn't do that. And you can also limit it to only connect to Wi-Fi if you want, which I think is a great inclusion on video streaming apps.
Now, it should be noted that T-Mobile has actually been doing this.
Yes.
If you sign up for their Binge On service, which, again, remember, it allows you to use any of the providers that have come inside of T-Mobile's network walls without affecting the cap. It's a, it's mm-hmm. a zero cap. They automatically throttled it. And people at it was a micro story for like half of a day where people were saying, oh, T-Mobile can't do that. They're throttling my data. And then people realized, actually, no, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
you know, because I, especially if I didn't buy into the Binge On, I don't want an hour of T-Mobile watching of Netflix to just eat everything I've got in my data cap. So I think we're starting to get used to this. This is not causing an outrage like it would have, say, mm-hmm. 6 months ago.
Well, I think it was like, oh, well, that's against net neutrality.
Right,
and then it was
right,
like, you didn't
right.
really think about it, and you're
you
like,
know,
oh,
T-Mobile
no,
holds the keys. Who gets in, you know,
right.
and they get to choose. But they've actually been pretty open, as far as I've seen. They've been really kind of opening the doors for all sorts of players to kind of get in on that.
We had the Chebert principle, because when that story about Binge On first came out, he said, if Netflix is true, I mean, if T-Mobile is truly convinced that this is net neutral and they're convinced that this approach is fair, then we will see a porn content provider jump inside of the walls. And that's exactly what happened. And Netflix said, yeah, I mean, we don't care. We're not making a judgment. We're just saying if you have users on our network, you can come on in. And so I think that's good.
That's probably does Chebert know that this principle was named after him?
He does now.
Okay. Excellent. Good to know. Sorry, Chebert. Continuing on with Netflix, Netflix CEO Reed Hastings told VentureBeat that it has no immediate interest in virtual reality and immersive video, unlike Hulu's announcement that we talked about on the show yesterday. Reed Hastings says that actually the VR market right now is tiny. And, you know, it also has other issues like exhaustion with long-term viewing, that sort of stuff. I found this kind of interesting because the way Netflix even started, it started well before this model was, you know, as, you know, anywhere near as widespread as it is right now. They kind of started with the forward-looking vision of this is the way it's going to be down the line. You know, of course, they were doing the DVD
right.
business in the beginning, but they named it Netflix. And they knew that their long-term strategy was to move into this area. So I'm kind of surprised that they aren't embracing VR in the same way.
I am, but I'm also not. In this sense, one of the things that made Netflix so big was that it was so easy and so accessible to everyone. If you had an internet connection and a browser, you could run Netflix. And that dropped the barrier to trying to watch streaming anything over the internet. I mean, it used to be you had content over here, you had content over here. Everyone had their own proprietary app, proprietary protocol. Mm-hmm. Netflix came in and they changed that. I understand what you're saying in that they were an early adopter of that. And as a result, they are at the top of the heap.
Right.
But at the same time, they're looking at VR and they're saying it's interesting, but it doesn't have that same low barrier to entry. It's not as if you have a computer and a browser, you can do it. It's if you have a powerful computer and if you have
the
a
hardware.
Relatively expensive VR headset. Mm-hmm. So they're saying, nice, but that's not where we are yet. We appeal to the masses, not to a specific performance junkie asset inside the fan community.
Sure.
Well, I think, yeah, they also go where the numbers are. You're sort of making it sound like they're just like, we just want to help everyone. And, but really, it's like they have so much data. They know where everyone is. And they're like, there's nobody there. It's such a small percentage of people that use VR. And so they want to get as many, you know, they know it's fascinating because their model is so different than because, you know, cable companies and TV stations were always just sort of guessing at who was watching when and when they were turning things off and turning things on. And it was all just like, you know, the ratings, the Nielsen ratings, and it was a guess. But Netflix knows everything. Yeah. I mean, they don't know exactly what we watch. They know the directors we like and the actors. I mean, they know everything, and they know
how
the
long
VR.
We watch when we stop watching.
Yeah, I mean, they know that VR is
exactly.
Small
they know what part of a TV series or a movie
most
that
people
we stopped,
stop watching,
and they can use that to. I mean, that's unheard of. I mean, if Nielsen had that kind of information, then they wouldn't be as irrelevant as they are right now.
Well, you know, with that kind of knowledge, then Netflix could figure out at what point in a VR experience most people get nauseous and take the goggles off.
Oh, actually, that's right. That would be great to figure out that point at which too much motion.
This is too much motion. Looking over the edge of the cliff, that's too much for most people. moving on.
And you can actually watch Netflix with VR goggles. It's just like the 2D. It's not the experience. Like, they're there. Like, sure, you can watch it, but it's not the same
pretty much anything.
Experience. So the pieces of the self-driving car puzzle are all coming together, people. Today, the Wall Street Journal reports that General Motors and Lyft will start testing self-driving Chevy Bolt electric taxis. And they say this is going to happen within a year. The plan follows GM's $500 million investment in Lyft that we reported a few months ago. The autonomous car technology will come from Cruise Automation. That's a company that GM has allegedly been planning to buy since March. So this is interesting. I mean, they're not saying where they're going to test it, but it's going to be like an opt-in or opt-out program. But it's great. It's great to get more electric cars on the road. And I think that's part of the Lyft deal, too. They'll like encourage drivers, Lyft drivers, to buy Bolts, or they'll have some sort of rental program. Yeah, so more electric cars are better, I think.
Yeah.
Would you, either of you,
would you
prefer a driverless taxi?
Sure.
I think with anything, there's a little hesitation when you try something for the first time, and especially when it's the kind of thing where what you're trying for the first time is, I'm going to get in this vehicle and let a computer drive me places, when we spent our entire lives relying on humans. I think it's the kind of thing that, yes, everyone's going to be reluctant to do it the first couple of times, but over time, and hopefully history bears this to be true, it's a safe experience, and there are probably other things that you end up enjoying out of that experience that you'll be less reluctant to do it in the future. I would certainly try it.
See, I'm even more positive than that, because I think an application like this has the possibility of really opening up a new crowd to the driverless cars, to the the automated vehicles, because so many people right now are saying either I'll never be able to afford one of those, or I would never put my, I'd like to be able to drive. I want to be able to take control. It's having something like a taxi, which is a relatively low entry into the market.
You already don't have control in a taxi.
You already have no control. Exactly. And you can have a good experience. Like, the car will show up when it says it's going to show up. You get in, you don't talk to anyone. Mm-hmm. And then you get out in your destination. And I think you do that enough times and people start saying, huh, nothing happened. This is actually a good thing. When I buy my next car, I'm going to make sure it has that technology.
It's like hopping on an escalator. Like, you know what I mean?
The first time.
I know that when I get on, when I get off, I'm going to be getting off at the second floor. Right. Like, it's going to get me to that destination. It's not something I ever consider. But probably the very first time that you hop on, it's a pretty scary experience.
Right. I wonder if this was the same transition they made when they moved from manually operated elevators to automatic elevators.
Oh, for sure. They kept elevator operators in there much longer than they were needed just to make people feel safe in them. And, yeah, so I think that they'll do this, too. Yeah, I mean, before it'll be offered to me, I feel like it'll be safer than you know getting in a taxi or an Uber or Lyft at this point. I feel bad for the drivers. Like whenever we talk about the issue of drivers, it's like, oh, this is such a short-term issue. You know, like it's great to be an Uber or Lyft driver and have that flexibility, but that is not a long-term career prospect.
You get that sense, right? It's sort of like, oh, people inside of Ubers, that was just a phase. Mm-hmm. The ultimate Uber is there's no driver, period.
Right, and that's obviously where they're going. Now, the initial trials will include human drivers in the sense that you know, they can take control if need be. I don't even know if we can have autonomous cars based on rules and regulations right now, laws that are in place in certain places. Wait, I don't know what I just said there. But anyways, there are laws that exist that basically say you need to have someone behind the controls.
We can't, but Canada can. Canada can. Canada has there are no laws in Canada that keeps a self-driving
car.
Canada
don't.
Off the street. Oh, my. How long have you been holding on to that one?
I don't even know where that came from.
Wow.
All right, moving on to a different car story that has nothing to do with Canada, as far as I know. It's official. The Tesla S is getting the equivalent of an in-app purchase. And do we like in-app purchases? I don't know. You know, some people obviously can't help but spend all their fortune on in-app purchases. Here, in this case, the Model S sedan comes with a reported 70 kilowatt hour battery. But if you're willing to pay $3,000, $3,250 to be exact, you can unlock the cheat code that magically turns that 70 kilowatt battery into a 75 kilowatt hour battery, and you don't even need a mage's magic spell to do it.
This is not the first time that they've done this. You will remember that earlier versions of their I think it was their Model S, also included you could buy the 60 kilowatt hour version, but you could upgrade it to 85 kilowatt hour with just a purchase. So they had all the batteries in there. All the hardware was already built into the car because it's cheaper to do it that way than to build two different types of battery packs. And then it's a software system. If you read the Reddit thread on it, people were starting to go, well, so how hard would it be to hack this?
That's what I was wondering.
Especially when you called it a cheat code. I was like, I would get that code.
Up, down, left, right. There we go. I don't know. There's part of me that says
it's an over-the-air update. They send an OTA update to your car, and it goes, okay, now you've got full access to the battery.
There's part of me that says this is ridiculous. If I paid for the hardware, I should be able to use it all. But then the other part is saying, wait, but you didn't pay for it. They basically gave you that part of the car for free.
They discounted that part of the car, essentially.
But that means I still have to carry around 5 kilowatt hours of batteries that I'm not using.
What a ripoff.
They did that with the autopilot too. Like that gets unlocked too. You pay more for that too. Yeah, it is an interesting model. It seems to be working. I mean, I don't know. Yeah, Elon Musk, his call was, there were so many gems in his call yesterday. Like apparently, like he's sleeping in the factory. He's got not full time, but he has a sleeping bag like at the factory line in order to make sure that, you know, all of the Teslas are being produced that he's promised.
Which, by the way, I grew up in Fremont, and that part of Fremont is not nice. So, yeah.
So get a down sleeping bag.
Well, he should get a Model X and sleep in one of those.
Yeah. I think he can do it. If anyone can do it, Elon Musk can do it. Can your Siri order a pizza for you based entirely on your voice commands and without requiring you to contact the pizzeria yourself? Huh? Huh? Megan?
No.
Can it?
My Siri can't do that.
Okay, well.
And I like pizza. Mm-hmm. My Amazon Echo can't order a pizza from anywhere either.
Really? Okay. Wow. They are severely lacking here. Mm-hmm. A new AI created by Dag Kutluss and 1/3 of the original Siri team proved their new AI assistant called Viv, which is 4 years in the making at this point, can do just that. For starters, its engineers actually tested it by speaking a string of pizza-related voice commands. And 40 minutes later, sure enough, the pizzas were delivered as they had hoped. Viv has been highly anticipated thanks to the people who are behind this technology, headed by Dag Cutlass, as I said, and Adam Shire, both co-founders of the original Siri before and, you know, early on after Apple bought the company and then transformed it into what Apple made, which they say they didn't really approve of. It was not the original vision that they had for Siri. This is.
Yeah, this is the real digital assistant, right? This is Jarvis from Iron Man, who can actually understand the context of your requests and come back with something that matches that, versus I can recognize what words you're saying and I can put them into Google, which is what Google Now and Siri basically are right now. Mm-hmm. Yes, they do have some functionality where they can control local functions on the device, but this is the promise of a Siri or a Google Now. The idea of saying, you know what, I'm hungry. And your phone says, well, you've got this, this, and this within range. Where would you like me to take you? That's an assistant.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's about partnerships, right? I mean, that's the thing that whenever you hear, like, here's what I found on the web for blah, blah, blah. It's like, I did not make a partnership with anyone that, like, because that's how the Amazon Echo works. Like, if you want to order a pizza, you can get it from Domino's, and that's it. You know, and that if you want to buy anything else, you get it from Amazon. You know, it's like about the partnerships. And I guess Apple didn't make any of them. And so that why it is so unsatisfying. I mean, yes, like, that's part of what we were talking about Apple Music yesterday. That's part of why I use Apple Music, because, see, I can say, like, you know, Siri, play the theme from Ghostbusters, and it will, you know, whereas it won't play it on Spotify. I don't know where that came from. I guess I listen to that regularly.
Do we really want that? I mean, do you want it that you can only order Domino's on Siri and Amazon, but if you want Roundtable, you need an Android phone. Little Caesars is only on Windows.
I need
phone.
An app to coordinate.
I don't want that, but that's how capitalism works, right? Yeah, I mean, that, you know.
So. Yeah, well, I mean, and what you see a lot in the current kind of crop of virtual assistants, at least on Android with Google Now, is that a lot of that kind of expanded functionality that you're talking about, instead of being partnerships, it's on the developers and the services to kind of do the work themselves. And how is that integrated? Because they've got an app installed on your device. So then it kind of taps in and can talk with Google Now. The app can talk back and forth with it. And this is kind of looking further than kind of the app world, you know, at least in the near term, and probably not very far out. The view is that apps are kind of fading. People are not installing as many apps anymore. And really, they're only using a handful of them on a regular basis. So why not make a service like this that doesn't rely on the apps and actually just kind of works without those ties? But yeah, I think the partnerships, that's actually a big challenge. If you want it to be totally cohesive and, you know, and cover all the bases, a lot of partnerships. I don't know if you can do that.
It's an exciting time, isn't it? Not too long ago, we were talking about how apps were replacing the web. And now it's, well, something else is replacing apps. And you get the sense of, it's not replacement. It's just the natural evolution of a human-computer interface.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, speaking of human-computer interface, after the break, if you have ever wondered how Scarlett Johansson's character in Her learned so much about the complicated nature of modern romance, Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed might have an answer. But first, let's take a minute to thank ZipRecruiter, the sponsor of this episode. Now, earlier this week, we got to talk to Ellen Pao and Erica Baker about their new venture Project Include that helps startup CEOs focus on inclusion in the workforce with care and thoughtfulness. Now, they say a lot of companies just focus on hiring more women, but what about inclusion with regards to age and religion and race, experience, disability, sexual orientation, and other aspects of diversity? If you are hiring and you want to find people like that, you have to post your job to find the best candidates. You have to post them everywhere. And if you care about inclusion, you need to post your jobs to all of the top job sites. With ZipRecruiter, you can do that. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. Don't leave it up to chance. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to more than 100 job boards, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter and Google+, all with a single click. Just post once and watch your candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. ZipRecruiter offers optimized pages that look great on any screen. Add their unique mobile apply process for more visitors and applicants. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can add multiple users to your account. Quickly screen candidates with real-world questions from using free-form, multiple-choice, or yes-no formats. View candidate responses in conjunction with their beautifully formatted resumes. Rate them and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. More than 100 million candidates' applications have been delivered. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. That's ZipRecruiter.com ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. So yesterday, Alex Kantrowitz from BuzzFeed reported that Google has been feeding some interesting text to an AI engine to make it smarter. Alex is here to tell us about this project. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So what kind of text is Google using?
All sort of text, but now it's moved on to a project where it's fed over 2,800 romance novels to its AI engine in an attempt to make it become more conversational and, you know, have a better tone and, that image. I've been looking at that image for the last few days.
Well, you did put it at the top of the article.
It is completely my fault. But, I mean, if you think about the books I had to choose from, that's pretty great.
Oh, what kind of romance novels are they using? I mean, is it period pieces and finely dressed dames, or is it 50 Shades of Grey?
It's really bad ones. They actually decided that they wanted to take them all from publicly available sources. So you're not getting the creme de la creme of romance novels. You're getting some really nasty ones. And seems to have worked okay.
When you say nasty, do you mean like not appropriate, or do you mean like just poorly written?
Well, that's the big debate. It's like, are the worst written romance novels the sauciest ones, or like, is a bad romance novel actually good? I really struggled with this question when writing the story. So,
wait, maybe another way to ask: are these romance novels written for men or for women?
I mean, either way you slice it, I wouldn't read it from the pulpit, man.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So what you say is that they're simple. Like, these stories are simple. It's, you know, boy meets girl, boy meets other girl, meets girl, boy, but, you know, and tragedy, right? Like, is that why they're using them?
Yeah, Google tells me that they were using them because they're all so similar. And they say the same thing in different words. So the plot is heartbreak, it's love triangles, and these are, it's addressing the same topic. I mean, think about it. How many different variations of romance can you have if you're looking at 2,800 books? It probably falls into like 3 or 4 categories. So as they see the same sentences, try to reach the same conclusions, it's a way to teach the AI, hey, there's different ways to say the same thing.
But when you're feeding AI that learns from everything that it reads and builds its knowledge around it, nothing but raunchy literature, aren't we just, like, teaching AI to be, I don't know, raunchy?
Are we just giving an AI a bunch of pickup lines?
Yes. is that what, like, I understand the premise, but yeah. I don't know. I mean, does it expand beyond this type of stuff into other literature, and so they'll kind of combine the learning that happens with this stuff with other things and go from there?
Right. That's a great question. So it's a technique. So basically what they've developed using the romance novels is they've given the AI one sentence. They've given the AI another sentence. And they've told the AI, why don't you write the sentences in between? And so by feeding it the romance novels, it has a text base to draw from and can help make that connection from the first sentence to the last sentence. And yes, they can use this same technique when they're trying to read, to use any other form of text. It's a technique that they've developed. It's more than just, you know, giving the AI all these books and saying, have at it. Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is it's not necessarily the content. I mean, so the romance novel industry is huge, huge. And like what you said, a lot of this is freely available. A lot of, there's a lot of consumption, a lot of production in this area. So it's got to be probably more simple than other texts. I mean, if we fed it all of Shakespeare, that wouldn't work as well.
Exactly. I mean, these are books that will repeat the same concepts over and over. And one thing that's interesting to note is it's not that they just teach like a central AI engine these romance novels, and then all of a sudden, all across Google, every type of product is trying to hook up with you.
It's not Tay. This is no Tay.
Not Tay. Yeah. Tay was like the very worst version of what this could be.
Got it.
And Google, without even me bringing it up in the interview, mentioned Tay. So they're very, very careful about creating another version of this. And what they'll do is they'll take the best stuff that they've learned and they'll put it in production in products like the Google app and Smart Replies. And they'll probably, I would imagine, put a much more toned down version than what we can find in some of the books.
The smart replies, yeah, like you can totally see where that could go wrong. But because you say that 10% of replies in Google's inbox app on mobile are smart replies. That was fascinating to me that it was so many. Such a large
percentage. Yeah, it's pretty amazing to think that the AI is writing so many of the responses that people are using. 10% is not an insignificant number.
No, it isn't.
One out of every 10 messages sent from that app is written by AI. Pretty good.
I use it pretty regularly.
Yeah, I mean, I use it more often now than I did at first. Like at first, I didn't want to like resort to a 2 or 3 line reply, but now I realize like actually it saves a lot of time. Yeah. All I really need to say is yes, thank you.
Right.
And I mean, if 10% of the users are actually using it, they're not using it just to use it. By and large, they're probably using it because it's actually very good at saying the thing that they would have said anyways. That's pretty impressive.
Alex, this is obviously big for natural language processing and for contextual processing. So if Google can get that going, fantastic. But it's also, this is a little bit of the dream of sci-fi, to create a nascent artificial intelligence and then just feed it as much knowledge, as much human content as we can give to it, and then it grows and grows and becomes intelligent. Obviously, we're not there yet because we're just trying to make it learn smart replies, but where would you put this on the spectrum of nascent singular artificial intelligence?
It's still pretty nascent. I think it's going to be a long time until we see some sort of Skynet version appear. But on the other hand, I did ask them whether or not someone can eventually fall in love with this type of AI. And they weren't even, Google wasn't even hesitant at all answering the question yes. So it's a matter, I think it's more of a matter of time before that happens as opposed to whether it will or whether it won't.
Well, yeah, I mean, that brings up Tay again, too, because, you know, the Xiao Ice, Microsoft Xiao Ice, everyone was telling it, you know, that they loved it. Whereas with, you know, Tay, they were teaching her to be racist. But then I think I might have read this, you might have wrote this, that the part of that is that that was in China where a lot of language is really locked down. So there's not a lot that you can say. I mean, you can't be as horrible as you can in the United States because we have free speech.
You know, we also have some very interesting elements here that are determined to destroy any sort of cool technology with any bit of has some leeway in its programming. So
just for the lulls,
our innovation here in the U.S.
Well, Alex, thank you so much. Alex Kantrowitz is at BuzzFeed News. You can follow him at buzzfeed.com or at Kantrowitz on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Take care, Alex. All right. So a little feedback here during our discussion regarding, so this was last week. And by the way, Mary Jo Foley kind of came on last minute. So we picked this email before we knew Mary Jo was going to be on. But basically, you may remember, go back in time last week when we were talking about Mary Jo Foley switching away from the Windows phone to Android. We made a comment along the lines of, most people simply don't use Windows phone. And I realize you're here, so you could correct me in my wrong statement there. Of course, we heard from someone who does. Derek emailed us at tnt@twit.tv to say, love the show, but I happily changed my iPhone 4S for a Lumia 640 LTE, and I took these attached photos with it. And of course, he went on to say he watches all the shows, including Know How and Twiet.
Oh, how about that?
Now. So, ooh, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad. So, you know, people use Windows Phone.
Derek uses Windows Phone.
Derek's a people.
Windows Phone is the best phone operating system and the best hardware that no one uses. It really is nice. I mean, I don't knock them. It's a beautiful device. It's a beautiful OS. It does exactly what I wanted to do. It just, in a market that's already so crowded by iOS and Android, there just wasn't space for it. It was too late, little too late.
Yeah. Well, that is the problem right there. Yeah. Thanks for writing in, Derek. Anyone can email us, tnt@twit.tv, and we will hopefully read it on the show. So please do that. All right, coming up next, we're going to take a look at immersive VR that's even more immersive than immersive VR. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that's Trunk Club. They're making me stylish. There are two types of men out there, guys who love shopping for clothes but are short on time, and those of you who hate it. Either way, take heart. Now you can get clothes that fit perfectly and look amazing without ever stepping into a store again. That's thanks to Trunk Club. You just type in your measurements, share your likes, your dislikes, the things that work for you, the styles that you're after. Your personal stylist will work with you and help you look and feel your best with clothes that fit you perfectly. perfectly. You know, sure, your stylist is a professional trained in all the brands that Trunk Club offers, but there's so much more to Trunk Club than just that experience. They'll actually pick your clothes from over 80 top brands. They're going to ship those right to your door in their trunk. So you get that huge trunk and you get to open it up and try them all on in your own space. See how they fit. Take a look. Do you like the V-neck thing or do you not? That was one of my challenges. I thought I didn't like V-neck. Turned out I actually did like some of these V-necks. So you never know. Keep what you like. Send back what you don't. Your stylist takes the time to understand your unique look. And by the way, if you happen to live in Dallas, New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, or D.C., you can stop by one of the Trunk Club clubhouses and you can work with your stylist in person. You'll feel like a movie star. Trunk Club is not a subscription service. Shipping is always free and you have 10 days to try on the clothes and you send back what you don't want to keep. Make a statement at the next big event on your calendar with a look that's handpicked just for you and your style. Get started with Trunk Club today. Premium clothes, expert advice, no work. Thanks to your very own personal stylist at Trunk Club. And Trunk Club is backed by Nordstrom, which means they have the highest standards in quality and customer service. Get started today. Just go to trunkclub.com/TNT and, start taking a look, see what they carry, sign up for, to get a call with a stylist and they'll pick out a trunk that's perfect for you. That's trunkclub.com/TNT. We thank Trunk Club for their support. All right. Virtual reality promises to transform what we think about entertainment and the immersive qualities of entertainment, but how do you take it one step further than just an HTC Vive in a living room? Joining us to talk all about The Void, I love that name, is Charlie Hall from Polygon. How's it going, Charlie?
Very well. How are you doing this evening?
We're doing awesome. It's great to get you on here. I was reading through your piece and I'm fascinated because I'm totally like, I'm in on the VR thing. I want maximum immersion. You start your write-up on your encounter with The Void by saying it's the most exciting VR experience you've had yet. What sets The Void apart from the rest?
You're completely untethered. I mean, that's the thing about The Void. They let you through the front door, and you're free to roam around. You're not tripping over the cables of the HTC Vive. You're not attached to your computer by a somewhat shorter tether like the Oculus is, and you're not, you don't have a phone strapped to your face like you do with a Gear VR. You are just out there running around.
So it's completely wireless?
It is. It's completely wireless. The way it's set up is there's a vest that is covered with kind of haptic sensors that shake when you get shot with the laser beams or whatnot. But then there's a computer on the back, and it's a specially designed custom board, custom everything on the inside. They worked with NVIDIA to build the thing to their exact specifications. And then there's a helmet that jacks right into it, and that's it.
Wow.
You're completely cut free.
All right. So explain a little bit of the experience that you encountered. I know it's a 30 by 30 room. You're wearing this huge backpack, this special kind of helmet. What did you see in The Void? What did you do?
Well, when the helmet was placed on me, the visor was brought down and there was a wall in front of me. In real life, there was a wall. But when the visor came down, it was the same wall. And I was asked to put my hand up on that wall. And then both in virtual reality and from the touch of my hand, that wall dissolved. And on the other side was a Mayan temple. And I just walked right through this plane. It was like a physical membrane that I passed through as the vest shook that I was wearing. And I was in there. And so it was an outdoor setting, and I went into this underground temple space under a Mayan ruin. And at one point, it opened up into a grotto. And so I was able to reach down my hands and grab the edge of the ledge that I was standing on. I was able to look underneath that ledge and see the cliff face that I was standing on and the water out there. And then this giant serpent, two stories tall, rose up in front of me and spit water in my face and blew hot air on my body. And it was all being triggered by the Void stage, as they call it.
You're actually feeling those things. So when the beast is blowing hot air on you, you actually feel hot air blown on your face.
That's exactly right.
That's
they've
so
got
crazy.
Heaters, they've got coolers, they've got misters. It's all rigged up in there.
Charlie, one of the big things about any VR experience where you get up, and this is why most VR experiences are still seated, at least for the Oculus Rift, is you may be in a virtual space, but you're also in a real space. And if the virtual space doesn't match up with the real space, you end up putting your head through a floor or trying to walk through a wall. But the Void uses something that they call redirected walking. Can you explain what that is? Because it sounds a little, well, interesting.
Well, one of the creators of the Void, his name is Curtis Hickman. He's actually a card-carrying magician. And he's designed illusions for people like David Copperfield and Chris Angel. This is not a joke of any kind. He's actually done these things. And he has perfected the art of redirected walking. So when I was traveling from one puzzle to the next within this Mayan situation that they've designed, I was actually walking in a circle. But to my eye inside VR, I was walking in a straight line. And the way that Curtis explained it to me is that the Void stage with the magic of redirected walking is effectively limitless. They can take people wherever they need to take them, as far as they need to go, by just having them walk in a circle when they think they're going in a straight line.
That's
and it works.
That's really trippy.
Yeah, that's a great way to use a small space.
So the video that we were watching is a PR video, I guess. When it came out, a lot of people thought this was fake, right? I mean, but you were there. It's not.
It's not fake. It's not fake at all. They took it to a TED Talk in Vancouver. They had people like Harrison Ford go through it and experience it. And it is no it works. But it's not done yet. Right? So there's a few limitations. The walls, for instance, are all only half height. Well, for the most part, they're half height. And that's because it's an optical tracking system that they're using. The system has to have a bead on what you're wearing with those little reflective balls that you would wear when you're doing motion capture or performance capture so that it can see you within the space. But eventually, they're going to have a radio frequency system. They'll be able to build those walls up a little higher, and it'll really, you know, it live up to its full potential from there.
Let's talk about that, building up walls, because they can keep the stage, the Void stage, fresh by moving things around, which are then incorporated into the VR. So, for example, there will actually be a hard surface where you think in VR there's supposed to be a control panel. So you're actually mm-hmm. touching a physical thing. In fact, I think the YouTube video showed that. Mm-hmm. How often do they have to switch things inside the room in order to keep it fresh? Or can they just use that redirected walking to have you use the same control panel five times, thinking it's five different control panels?
The Void stage that I was on was actually called a quarter stage. It's 30 by 30. The full Void stage is 60 by 60. So it's four times larger. And there's many more types of corridor layouts in that larger stage. But with the quarter stage that I was on, they took me back through it without VR on. I wasn't able to take any pictures or anything, but I could see, like, well, this is the room you're in twice, and this is the hallway you're in three times, and they showed me behind the scenes how it works. With a larger stage, there's less of that. There's more different kinds of intersections that they can have. But they've also designed the Void stage to work like Legos, they said. They can take it apart. They can reconfigure it. They can rebuild it in different shapes. But then they can overlay it with all these different virtual environments.
This is like modern day laser tag, but like on steroids,
right.
or modern day arcade, because arcades hardly even exist anymore, you know, and the virtual reality, you know, the future that we have that's right on the horizon of virtual reality. I could see these installations all over the place and people would pay good money for an experience. What are their plans as far as that is concerned, as far as kind of, I mean, this is in what, outside of Salt Lake City, I believe. Do they have plans for expansion? How much would they charge? Do we have any details there?
Some of the details they were able to give me, you know, one of the target prices they talked about off the top of their head is like $30 to $40 for a 25 to 35 minute experience. They also talked about, you know, a franchise model or a mm-hmm. partnership model, or perhaps a pop-up model. So there's a number of different ways that they can do it with their quarter stage, or by putting multiple full stage 60-60 setups into a facility. They've already got architectural renderings of that facility as they envision it.
I love that idea because, I mean, as it stands now, the technology is not that's out there is not accessible to most people. I mean, we have the Vive here set up. It's right next to our office. We have everybody coming in. Like,
have you used the Vive, Megan?
Right. One of our producers, okay, like, brought her kids in. Like, it's a, you know, it's just like it's
fun.
Yeah. I mean, but I love the idea that it would be a destination.
Mm-hmm. And the way that they've Here's the other part of the story, though, right? Curtis Hickman, his father, is Tracy Hickman. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever played D&D, Dungeons and Dragons, you know Tracy Hickman. He's the guy that invented, that designed the famous Ravenloft campaign. He's one of the co-creators of the Dragonlance series. So for the last year, they've had Tracy Hickman wailing away at the story Bible for the Vive universe. So it's not just a Mayan temple. It's not just an alien encounter where you're shooting it to bugs on the floor. There's a whole interconnected series of experiences. There's secrets to unlock. Imagine, you know, in classic D&D fashion, you go up to the secret wall and you put in the right, you know, you scry the right figure on that wall and it dissolves in front of you and you're in a brand new place in an environment that you were at last week and you didn't know this door was here.
Yeah, that's incredible. The more we kind of talk about this thing, the more I realize, like, they're sitting on a gold mine, yeah. Honestly. If they can figure out how to kind of bring this to a mass distribution sort of thing so that, you know, many people can get on it. And I imagine from a technological standpoint, because they're not going with an Oculus. They're not going with an HTC Vive as far as we can tell here. They're kind of rolling with their own. So I imagine there's challenges kind of scaling that.
It's a custom-built system, and the new headset that they're coming out with very soon is going to have curved OLED displays, so it's very light. They're going to be 2K per eye with a full 180-degree field of view. But, you know, that wasn't the system that I played with. The RF, best I can figure, is still on the drawing board as far as that radio frequency non-line sight tech goes. But the backtop's done. You know, you'd think that the computer, running around with a computer powerful enough to drive this whole thing, would be one of the biggest stumbling blocks. But they've got it nailed, they say.
Yeah, excellent. Fascinating stuff, Charlie. And really appreciate you coming on to kind of tell us all about your unique experience, to say the least. Charlie Hall, where can people kind of follow the work that you're doing online, your Twitter account, all that kind of stuff?
My Twitter account, Charlie_L_Hall, and I'm the features writer over at Polygon, and I'm doing long-form stuff and investigative stuff and video stuff. I got a podcast called Polygon Backstory that I put up irregularly, but Twitter's a good place.
Excellent. Charlie, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Take care.
He was falling into the void there.
He's falling into the void. Yeah.
Internet void.
All right. Well, in a segment that is soon to be renamed Dueling Lawnmowers, right. TNT's fan of the day is Gary Ashton at Hobby Bounce on Twitter. He sent us this picture of himself on a riding lawnmower. Props to Gary for getting this image past Twitter's objectionable image filter for having a lawnmower there. Yeah, apparently a past lawnmower photo did not make it there. He says mowers are keeping up with all the latest tech.
That's right.
Yes.
This is how you do it. This is how you mow.
We apparently have a lot of people that listen to us while they mow the lawn, which is great.
When I was a kid and I mowed a lot of lawns when I was a kid, I always had headphones in and I was listening to something.
I had the little mechanical, like, rolly lawnmower. I didn't have a riding mower.
Oh, my. Yeah, upgrade.
Man. I'd love a riding mower. It'd become a racing mower.
I had a riding lawnmower. It was awesome.
Yeah, my kids, we have a riding lawnmower, yeah. They're 11. 11 is apparently not too young to mow the lawn. They do mow it, so yeah, until we have our self-driving lawnmower.
Now my house, we have AstroTurf, so I don't do much lawn mowing.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. You need that, or you need a Roomba lawnmower.
Yeah. Yes.
That just kind of goes out there and just mows all the time.
That exists, I think.
It probably does.
Well, show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook. Use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it. Up next, we've been told that some controversial cell phone tracking technology is being used by police, but only to catch terrorists. That's what we've been told. So why do public records show that it's been used to find the thief of $50 worth of chicken wings? Padre will explain.
Yes, why, Padre? But hold on to it.
First, let's take a minute to thank Blue Apron. Speaking of food and chicken wings.
Speaking of chicken wings.
The sponsor of this episode. If your chicken wings got stolen, you'll want to listen to this. We all know home-cooked meals are usually lower in calories and fat, but there's something else about making your own food that just feels good. For me, it reminds me of my mom, who was and still is a great cook. That trait seems to have skipped a generation. I can follow a recipe, but I'm not creative when it comes to the kitchen. And I'm usually right here talking about tech news where I should be home looking for recipes, going to the grocery store, all that stuff that my mom used to do. But I'm here. I'm talking about technology with you. Blue Apron, thankfully, has me covered. For less than $10 per meal, Blue Apron delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store. No more sad takeout. No more leaving your tech podcast to go to the grocery store. No matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like spicy vegetable tteokbokki with asparagus, soft-boiled eggs and ginger cashews, or pork roast and mashed potatoes with molasses-stewed collard greens right in your own kitchen. Recipes are between 500 and 700 calories per portion, delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first two meals free just by going to blueapron.com/twit. Check out this week's menu and get your first two meals free by going to blueapron.com/twit. And we thank Blue Apron for their support of Tech News Today. The Register reports that cops in Maryland used a Stingray cell tower simulator to track down a man who committed the heinous crime of stealing 15 chicken wings and 3 sandwiches. Padre, discuss.
Okay, so first of all, I'd have to say, look, stealing chicken wings is a serious crime. But once we look past that, we have to consider what this is. So remember, we're bringing stingrays back into the news. They made a big splash last year. They've kind of fallen out of our vision as a tech people. But essentially what they do is they take advantage of a fundamental weakness of every cell phone. I don't care who makes it or what carrier you're on. And that is a cell phone will automatically try to connect to the strongest signal available. That's its job because it wants to get you that call. It wants to make sure you continue your data connection. What they figured out was they could make a tower, their own custom tower, that was just a little bit stronger than all the real towers. And your phone would connect to it, and then it would pass the traffic on to a legitimate tower. But what happens is when you connect to that Stingray, to that dirt box, first, your data is no longer encrypted. So they can look at absolutely everything that's flowing through. But also, it's a fundamental breach of privacy. It's already been determined in the courts that any law enforcement agency that wants to use a Stingray, wants to use a dirt box, actually has to get a warrant for it. Unless, and here's the little legal loophole here, it's a serious crime that they're tracking after. And what they look for is they look for terrorism. If you're tracking down a terrorism with an imminent threat, sure, you should be able to use every tool that's at your disposal. But now they're looking at this story and saying, $50 chicken wing thief, is that really what we're going to use it for? But it's so difficult. And this is what privacy advocates have been saying for so long. It's so difficult once you have a tool in place, even if it's only supposed to be used for the worst of the worst, to not use it just to make solving a smaller case easier. It sounds funny, but this is actually an important story. Will they use stingrays more and more, just justifying it and saying, well, you know, it was too hard to track you down the old-fashioned way, so I took out my dirt box.
I mean, that was a big reason why the whole Apple encryption FBI thing was even a thing, because, you know, Apple and many people concerned with security and privacy argued that, okay, you're saying this would be used for one single phone, but the reality is
you can't.
If you have a key that opens a door and you need access to the thing that's on the other side of that door, are you going to use the key? Yep. Because it's way easier than doing what you had to do before, which was a lot more to get around that door.
And this is that slippery slope in action, because try to think of it the other way, which is,
right,
well, we paid $250,000. By the way, these are kind of expensive. Mm-hmm. We paid a lot of money to get these installed. Why wouldn't we use it? Mm-hmm. If we paid the money already and we have a crime that we can solve, shouldn't we have access to that? And people are saying, well, yes and no. I mean, did you go through the proper channel? Did you get a warrant, or are you just fishing to look for a conviction? And we don't allow that. That's our system of law does not allow for that.
So why did they pay for them? Like, what were they using them before for? Do we not know?
We can guess. The problem is these came from the FBI. So all of these localities, these law enforcement agencies, got them from the FBI, but they got them from the FBI with a grant with the stipulation that they never talk about them. It was actually written up. They can't acknowledge that they were using it. They couldn't acknowledge when they had turned them on, and they couldn't say where they got them from. So the knowledge that we have about stingrays it's basically been open source gathered mm-hmm. by people who are interested in privacy.
Right. So yeah, this was an article in the Register, but that came from like just a lot of yeah. requesting of public records over and over in order to just get this information. So what do you say? I'm just playing devil's advocate here, but yeah, what do you say to people who say like, well, that was a crime. Like we want to fight crime, and right, like we have paid for that. So what do you say to that?
We have the tool.
Well, I mean, and this is where it gets touchy, because we could say, look, we've got a system for this. You get a warrant. If you have someone who you think is under suspicion for committing a crime, you get a warrant just like you would for anything else. This is just another forensic tool. But in order for that to work properly, you actually have to start collecting data, because a warrant does you no good to find something that happened in the past. Mm-hmm. So you know, we're now in this weird juggling ethical legal morass where can we trust law enforcement to do what they say they're going to do? If we trusted them that they would get a warrant and that they would collect data but only use it when they have a warrant, I think most of us would be okay with it. Unfortunately, most of us have experienced the opposite, which is, as you said, once they have the tool, they're going to use it every chance they get.
Mm-hmm.
So there is no federal law against using or around using the stingray. There's no law that says it's just you got to have a warrant. But there's no law about how they can use it other than that?
Well, technically it's illegal because the FCC doesn't let you cause interference, and that's what you're doing when you run a stingray. But who listens to the FCC?
I mean, when chicken wings are at stake.
And that's the other thing. I mean, Megan, I mean, seriously, if someone took my chicken wings, $50 worth of chicken wings, I'd want them back.
Yes, exactly. I have one more question about this. But so are they also getting everyone else's information? So like if yes. I'm following mm-hmm. this chicken wing thief, they get everything off of my phone too.
That's the other problem. You cannot target a person. When you increase the power of this fake cell tower,
you just slurp it all up.
Yep, you're a vacuum. Everyone's phone gets in there. In fact, a while back, I showed off an app for KnowHow that allows you to figure out when the connection is broken and when you've now attached to a dirt box. Driving around 10 square blocks in San Francisco, I hit a dirt box at least 5 times. So they're in use.
Well, thank you for enlightening us. Thank you for answering all my questions.
Hopefully that makes you feel safe.
This cheery story to end the show on.
Well, it's so funny because it's like I ask you these questions all the time. I'm like, we should do a podcast. We should record your answers.
So here, we'll just invite you on our podcast.
That probably shouldn't have been the kicker. That was kind of a downer kicker.
We should have ended with Canada or
something.
Yeah,
if we have to lead with chicken wings to get to make sure people know this is going on, then, you know, we do. Well, thank you so much. You're, of course, on KnowHow twice a week and all the other shows that you do. You do This Week in Enterprise Tech.
I'm the same.
Plus, you're just talking to me. I'm just asking you questions. Again, we should record that. This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Yes. Actually, we're doing a lot of fun projects right now. On KnowHow, we're playing with stepper motors, which we're going to use to home-built sort of a pan-tilt-zoom camera platform like we had in NAB. But we're going to do it for a couple of $1,000 less than what those would cost. And on This Week in Enterprise Tech, we're going into a series where we're actually talking to people who are helping set up more sensitive secure areas. So if you like security, if you like playing with robotics, or if you just like playing with food, because we're doing geek cooking on KnowHow as well, don't forget you can find me on Thursdays with Brian Burnett and on Fridays with Brian Chi and Curtis Franklin and Lou Maresca.
Fantastic. Always a pleasure getting you on the show.
Yes, always fun.
Thank you.
And I know your Thursdays are always super slammed, so sorry to tack on yet another show for you. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can always be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail. That's 260-TNT-SHOW. And you can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
And have you stumbled upon this show and you want to know how to get it right to your ears or your eyes as quickly as possible for the rest of your life? Go to twit.tv/TNT and subscribe to the show, or subscribe through Google Play or iTunes or Overcast or Downcast or Pocket Cast. And Patrick tells me there's a Windows Phone app. So all of you, Derek.
Wait a minute. Windows Phone can get podcasts?
Yes, Derek and all the others of you, the many others with Windows Phones, you can get it there. Roku, Apple TV. And if you want to find me, I'm on Twitter, Megan Maroney.
I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to our technical director, Kara Cole, and all the folks, every single one of them, Greg, who help us produce the show every single day, Tony. And thanks to you for talking tech with us. We'll see y'all tomorrow. All right. Three-way high five. That works.